So we're going to be thinking not about that in this first talk. We're going to be thinking, when I can get this set up. Still getting used to this. Where is B? Letter B. Oh, dear. Here. Right. Okay, we're going to be thinking about biomimetics. For those of you who don't know what biomimetics is, it means learning from nature, as it says there, or learning from the created world. So I'm going to be just for a few minutes talking to you about some of the things that I've been doing and some of the things that other people have been doing. Biomimetics is, you're going to have to move some of you. Perhaps I need to move this even further over. Is that all right? Can you all see? Christine, can you see? Right. I'm trying to make sure you can all see. Are you tucked away around the corner there? Can you see? Right. Okay. Good. Right. Okay. I think I'll speak mainly from this area, but I might move around a bit. Okay. So the lotus leaf is one famous example where water just runs off a leaf. Gecko foot, where they make robots from an amazing foot, which is made of tiny little hairs. Burdock plant led to Velcro, which we're using constantly every day. The Wright Flyer, actually, way back in 1903 in North Carolina, in Kitty Hawk, on a cold December day. It wouldn't be cold here, of course, then, but I grant you that here it would be warm. But in North Carolina on 1903, December the 17th, it was cold. But a famous biomimetic event took place, because what had happened was that the Wright brothers were copying birds. And they understood birds and the way they flew, and they made the first man-made powered flight, which was controlled. The emphasis on control, because Richard Pearse from New Zealand might lay claims to being the first one to do it, but actually his was not terribly controlled. It was the Wright brothers who did it in a controlled way. The Scottish broom, knobcone pine, I'll mention that later, and of course the Bombardier Beetle, which is the thing that I've been working on. I've still got two surviving at home, unless my wife has killed them off in the meantime. But there we go. And I'm good. We've also got an example of the kinesin walking protein, which, if I have time, I will mention. So, yeah, I'm going to mention that now. I'm not going to say an awful lot about it, but you can even go right down to the molecular scale, and you get some things which are waiting to be copied. Nobody's copied this yet. But I thought this would just thrill you to see that there are some amazing molecules which actually walk, right? They walk by, it's all to do with ATP chemistry, those of you who know biochemistry. It's to do with the hydrolysis and unbinding and binding again of ATP. And it's a thermodynamic marvel. The whole thing is just unbelievable when you watch this video as you see it walking. Right, so I'm just going to show you this.
Meet the kinesin. Masterpieces of microengineering, kinesins are miniature motorized machines that carry cargo from one part of the cell to another, walking along self-assembling highways called microtubules. Known as the workhorses of the cell, kinesins have 2 feet, or globular heads, that literally walk 1 foot over another along the microtubule, pulling their cargo to its destination. Each foot possesses 2 special locations, called binding sites, that interact with other molecules. One site attaches to the microtubule, and the other binds with ATP, the energy molecule of the cell. When 1 foot binds with ATP and uses its energy, the foot flips over, resulting in the walking motion. Each foot has a short neck, which is connected to a strand of a long coiled stalk. At the end of the stalk is a fan-shaped tail, which holds tightly to the cargo being transported.
That is just staggering, and that's waiting to be copied. So that's not yet been copied. But if they do manage to copy it, who holds the copyright? So these are things which are so small, 100 steps are done in a second, and 8 nanometers, which is a millionth of a millimeter, are going in each step. And there is a self-assembling road, as you noticed, also going on at the same time. I'm going to now talk to you about something else which I have written on. And again, it's not yet been copied, but I think it's waiting to be copied. These things show the amazing things which are in nature already. And one of the things which is feeding innovation in the scientific world today is copying that which is already in nature. And it raises issues as to who put it there. If you say that it's evolved, then you're almost undermining your own design position as an engineer in copying it, because you're really acknowledging that somebody has really designed it. You might try and loosely use the word as an engineer, oh, there it is, evolved. But then, really, the very fact that you are looking for innovation in a design context really is revealing what really is happening. What has really shown by that kinesin walking molecule is that there is an intricacy, in that case, of molecular design. Let me show you something which is to do with fire. You know the old adage that you shouldn't play with fire. Well, that you need to bear that in mind, because here is something which is going to burn, and you'll see it burning shortly. But for a long while, it doesn't burn. It's a cone. It's an oddly shaped pine cone. It's very asymmetric. It grows on the rocky slopes and ridges of the coastal mountain areas in northwest USA, between about 800 to 1,300 meters. And each cone doesn't have a stalk. It's just part of a little whorl going round, as you can see there, going round the branch. They're closed for years, and the cones remain closed sometimes as much as 30 years. And when forest fires kill the trees, it's only that that opens them. Each seed is very small inside, just a few centimeters long, and it's trapped there, and nothing will break it open except, as you shall see, the force of fire. Let's just watch this video. Whoops. Whoops. Here we are. Can you turn up the sound a bit?
The balance of life on Earth sometimes hinges upon the most unlikely of relationships. In a forest of knob cone pines, the importance of natural forces to the dispersal of the seed reaches its apex. Throughout the Pacific Northwest, the knob cone pine is known to produce some of the world's hardest and most protective cones. Growing in clusters around the limbs, these curiously shaped vessels possess a quality shared by few others. They refuse to open and release their seeds from one year to the next. Instead, like impenetrable fortresses, they remain sealed, strong enough to withstand the blows of a hammer and a forest of seed-hungry predators. Even time and weather fail to take their toll, as each cone's vice-like grip holds fast, often for decades. With rare exception, in all of nature, only one force is strong enough to break their hold. The searing heat of a forest fire triggers an amazing chain of events, and the cones begin to crack. By opening only partially and emitting a gaseous vapor, most of the seeds are insulated from the killing flames. Thank you. Only when the fire has passed will the charred cones open fully. The miracle of a forest rebirth then takes its course.
So that is really, truly astonishing, because you've got a number of factors which have to be right. You can't play with fire, right? You're in danger of burning the whole cone up and its seed as well. But there is a number of features which are built in to stop that. Nothing opens it, of course, until we get fire. But only then the fire opens it partially, not completely. So the technical term for this is that you're going through a hysteresis effect. It only partially opens. It'll never close properly ever again. But what's happened is that initially, at the very hot conditions, it doesn't open fully. And there is an insulating gas to stop the seed burning. Then there is, obviously, the fire finishes and it goes off. The fire finally moves on, or it dies out. And only then, after the fire has passed, do the cones open fully. Normally that wouldn't happen. But you got beyond this temperature where the cones open, and when it cools, it opens further. It's the most odd effects. There is an opening and closing, actually, which can carry on for quite a few years afterwards. So there is a special intricacy in the design. There is an irreducibly complex system here, because you're in danger either of not propagating the tree at all. And by the way, the Banksia tree in Australia also apparently has the same issue, that it has cones which only open under forest fire conditions. So you're either not going to propagate the tree at all, or else you're going to burn the very seed that you're trying to drop out. The seed has to drop out after the ground has cooled. How remarkable there is a feature. How remarkable the features of design. Remember that there was only the partial opening, there was the insulating gas and the gas emission protecting the seed, and then the cones only operating such that they opened fully after the fire has passed. Well, there is a number of possible biomimetic applications here. One of them is the sealant, which actually keeps the cones closed, which only will melt at a certain temperature. That could be used for fireproofing materials. So people haven't yet picked it up, but at least there is the possibility of copying it. But I think you know the one that I'm coming to, which I really want to speak about most, is this one. It's the bombardier beetle. The bombardier beetle is an amazing little critter. And in 2010, the University of Leeds, which had previously been rather, well, shall I be kind to them, a little bit dismissive as to my convictions, to put it mildly, when it comes to getting prizes, they get interested. And it won a prize in the 2010 Times Higher Educational Supplement, or whatever it's called, Outstanding Contribution to Innovation and Technology. And their name is on it, quite rightly so, because they have, to a certain extent, backed it, and Elsevier runs that competition. And, of course, I must remember Swedish Biomimetics 3000, which is the company which has sponsored this work. Quite a number of people have taken an interest in it. It's been on various programs over the years. Various groups, like even Scientific American, have reported on it. And they wouldn't report on what my convictions, of course, but they will gladly promote the science, which is fair enough. I don't mind that. as long as they're accurate in what they do. Number of people have actually promoted it, and even the Bias Broadcasting Corporation, sorry, the British Broadcasting Corporation, did do a little program on it as well. But it's an example of oscillatory combustion. It's a classic example of biomimetics, copying nature with a view to using it in engineering. The core technology is a combustion chamber with valves and a nozzle. Its application is to a number of areas, like nebulizers for people who perhaps have breathing difficulties, fire extinguishers, fuel injector, that's in the lead application at the moment from the company, aerosols, and also other things as well, which are being mooted. Fragrances is another one where people are thinking of using it. It's still early days. It takes ages to go from a patent to get something produced in industry. And if you think I made loads of money out of it, hardly anything, right? And probably I've all made very little out of it. So I might, maybe my grandchildren might get something out of it. So there you go. I'll be dead and done for by that time. And I won't need a biomimetic fuel injector in heaven, as far as I know. But there we go. So I need to give credit scientifically to the person whose paper inspired me. Sadly, this gentleman has died now, but he was a... I didn't realise we were playing it. I'll come to that in a moment. The gentleman who inspired all this work, humanly speaking, is Tom Eisner. He's died now. He was working at the university in Cornell, which is a well-known Ivy League University in New York State in the US. And he wrote a paper published in 1999 with a lot of photographs of this amazing bombardier beetle. And I suddenly realized how relevant it was to the fact that I do combustion. I know quite a lot about fluids. I know about liquids and air. I know about aeronautics and that sort of stuff. And here was a beetle which uses combustion. And I was intrigued when I saw these photographs of what he'd done. I thought, wow, I need to understand this more. So I read up a little bit about it, and Tom Eisner graciously welcomed me to his laboratory. We had a few meetings together, and he even signed me a copy of his book, which is very interesting, For the Love of Insects. For those who are squeamish about some insects, and I must admit I don't particularly love the spiders, but he's written a lot in that book, including the bombardier beetle. This is the noise. That's what you actually hear in his laboratory. It's a little beetle about 2.5 centimetres long. The one that you're looking at there, or we're looking at there, is the African bombardier beetle. I'm not quite sure which part of Africa it comes from. But they tend to roam all over the place. You've probably got some just out here, if only you look properly. And they're even in England, right? They seem to enjoy wandering around on the south coast. And they've even been found in Wales near a power station. Need a little bit of warmth, but they're usually not far away from water. They love hiding under stones, like all beetles do. And they will squirt if you surprise them. And here's the one from Wales. And here's another little picture, close-up, of these bombardier beetles. The ones I've got were from California, and they're not particularly very large. This is from the film that the BBC did, Alien Empire, which demonstrates its firing ability, slowed down a bit so that you can understand it.
Few creatures will risk annoying a bombardier beetle. It mixes a cocktail of deadly chemicals in a special chamber. They react and explode at boiling point from its rear end in an awesome chemical weapon.
Now, the question is, of course, has this beetle evolved? Now, Tom Eisner certainly was of the view that it had evolved. And if you read his papers, he sincerely believed that actually beetles which no longer spray hot spray have gradually evolved until they spray the hot spray like that beetle did just then. I think it's the reverse. I think actually that the bombardier beetle actually had this sophisticated equipment and it has gradually mutated and in some cases lost the ability. But it's very sophisticated, as you will see. It's not simple. And for us to understand what was going on, we had to accept that some dissections had to be made of these beetles. Apparently, Tom Eisner got to know individuals. I don't know how he did, but apparently he did. You know, so this today it's Gertrude's turn to go into the freezer, and then you cut her up and see what's inside. So that's the sort of relationship he had with his beetles. But sorry to put you off eating beetles next time you're offered them, but there we go. So these are the beetles, right? And here's a little bit more of the video footage to explain what's happening with these beetles.
One of the really amazing things about this animal is its ability to spray in a very beautifully aimed fashion. And that shows up very nicely when you put the animal on indicator paper. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to pinch very lightly one leg after the other, just as if I were an ant biting these legs. I'm going to start with the right hind leg, right front leg, left front leg.
At 400 frames per second, the action has been slowed down, but not enough to see the individual pulses. So they went to a lab and filmed the beetle at an even faster speed, at an incredible 4,000 frames a second. There were the pulses, each one corresponding to the individual bursts of sound.
So it was when we saw that footage that we realized that something extraordinary is really going on. Tom Eisner had already understood that there was individual explosions of the order of 500 per second. 400 to 500 per second. We call this pulse combustion. You take the fuel and the air in normally, but in this case, the air is not taken in. It's hydrogen peroxide. If you know anything about chemistry, hydrogen peroxide is sometimes used in diluted form for a bleach. If you use it in concentrated form, you dissolve everything inside. But it's an oxidizer, right? It's sometimes used as a bleach. And the hydrogen peroxide is taken in with a chemical called hydroquinone, which has got a carbon in it, so it is burnable. And if you combine that with hydrogen peroxide, you're going to get benzoquinone, and you're also going to get some water. This is in a mixture of what is already water. It is an exothermic, that means it's a gives off heat reaction. So that means that it heats up the rest of the water, which means that you get boiling hot caustic liquid, but which wants to vaporize, coming out in the face of a predator, which could be a wolf spider or just any spider, could be a bird, it could be an ant, or it could be a frog, which is trying to eat them, eat this beetle. The beetle invariably wins. There are a few occasions where it doesn't, but generally it wins. It doesn't kill its predator. It just stuns the predator. It's a bit like a pepper spray, you know, that ladies sometimes will take for obvious reasons. And you blast it in the face of the person who's trying to get you, and it stops the attack in its tracks. And here's the mixture coming in. There is an explosion, and the explosion itself stops more fuel and air coming in, all right, hydrogen peroxide coming in. So that means that the same pressure will now push the stuff out of the backside. We realized that there was a very sophisticated inlet valve which was this. But what we hadn't realized until later was that there was also an exhaust valve. It was actually a pressure relief valve. This chamber is only 1 millimeter long. The beetle is about 2 centimeters long, right, about that. And then you've got to really go into the microscopic level to see the combustion chamber. And would you believe it's got two of them? So I call it a twin carburetor beetle. Wonderful machine, right? And it can really go places. But it's not the only thing that used that principle. The V1 in England, we were suffering from some people who were trying to, get onto our territory. And in 1944, the doodlebug was being dropped all over Kent, Surrey, and London. And many people were killed by those. The only thing which could stop them was the Spitfires flying very, very close, just so close that their wings touched the V1, and they flipped it over, and it went down into the British Channel. But it was a very difficult maneuver to do. Some were successful, but you were in danger of getting yourself, down in the drink as well. But that was what happened. But it was powered by petrol, or as the Americans like to call it, gasoline, and air. So instead of it being hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinone, it was air and petrol. So it was an air-breathing engine. But it was constantly having an explosion, closing the door of the inlet by that very explosion, and pushing out the exhaust at the back, which pushed the V1 forward. And there is a great similarity. But the inventor of the V1, which wasn't von Braun, it was somebody else. But the inventor of the V1, von Braun invented the V2, but there was somebody else who invented the V1. He was not aware of the bombardier beetle, so he was not actually... it's not an example of biomimetics. But he hadn't realized, or at least Hitler hadn't realized, that there was already an example of this technology in nature. That was only discovered by Tom Eisner, and I guess yours truly understood, and I actually said to Tom Eisner, there is another valve here, and I'm coming to that. So this is what's happening. Can we have the sound up again, please? Thank you. It's a cannon, or whatever you want to call it, It's a series of explosions pushing this stuff out. And the fact that the explosions are going on at between 400 to 500 times per second is picking out a pure note. Eep, right? That is about 400 cycles per second. Middle C, which has just been on this piano. I don't know who was playing the piano, but if they could play middle C, it would be... middle C, right? We start tuning up the orchestra, middle C, you do it at A, which is a bit higher up. Okay, but 400 to 500 cycles per second is E. You can actually hear the note, and that's what you're hearing. You're hearing a pure note as the beetle has this blast. The chemistry is quite complicated, and I'm now beginning to... I've just heard wind that the University of Mississippi has got a little grant to help look at the chemistry with me of the bombardier beetle. So even though I've retired, I haven't fully retired, I'm still keeping my hand in with a few other guys in other parts of the world who have some sympathy to some of the convictions I hold. As you know, I believe very much in creation, and I have no doubt that this bombardier beetle did not evolve. Because as I said to you, you can't play with fire. You've got a bit of a problem if you're a bombardier beetle. I'm personalizing it because evolution's got no mind. It's got no purpose, but let's personalize it. So this creature, whatever it is going to evolve into a bombardier beetle, has a little bit of an experiment, and it's playing around with fire, and makes a mistake because it hasn't got all the equipment to contain the blast, and it's in danger, of course, of blowing itself to bits. That is one obvious danger. The other danger is that it thinks it's got it ready and it hasn't, And it gets eaten anyway by a wolf spider or a frog or a bird or an ant, whatever. So there's quite a few things which have to be right for this beetle to work. It's also got to have the sensing mechanism. I'm not going to talk about that today. But if you notice, it was not looking at where the forceps were coming when it grabbed, I think, the back right leg. It knew that the attack was coming from that direction, and it moved this tiny little turret, which has got a set of movable, you know, it's like a tripod stand going into each other, and it moves that in any direction it wishes and senses where the attack is coming from. Nobody's quite worked out all the sensory mechanism there, but that is waiting to be copied. It also has the ability to even attack right over its head and go forwards. In fact, I had a picture of it going forwards right at the lead page on this work. It's quite an amazing thing. Now, the chemistry is interesting. It's hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide going to benzoquinone and water. But it isn't just that. There's got to be a catalyst. And the catalyst is catalase and peroxidase. Now, if you know anything about chemistry, you can't just sort of wave a magic wand and hope that it'll all work out. No. You'll end up with the right mess if you do that with a chemistry lab. You've actually got to have these catalysts being ready just at the right moment. Now, the catalysts, we think, are in solid form inside the combustion chamber. So when the two chemicals, which come in, by the way, together and have not burnt, it's amazing this, the two chemicals come in down one long tube and they come into the combustion chamber. They come in and they sense the enzyme or the catalyst, which then causes that explosion to go 10 times more than that, 1,000 times faster. You can actually put hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide into a test tube and it'll do nothing, right? If you get not the catalyst that I'm talking about, but you can use a metal catalyst, if you get aluminium filings, some of you are going to do this. I can just see Bowker's going to do that when you go home, aren't you, Bowker? Or is it Luke? Luke's going to do it. So Luke's watching avidly. But you make sure he doesn't blow himself to bits. But I'll burn the place down. But if you get this test tube and you now pour in aluminium filings, off it goes. I'm sorry, I haven't got the footage handy to show you, but somebody at Liberty University actually demonstrated this, and I did take a footage. I must get hold of it. But it really does happen like that. So you need the catalyst. So how many millions of years went by while this creature, which was hoping to get back at its predator, developed a catalyst to come at the right moment? People try to argue, as they seriously do, that this system gradually evolved. My opinion is that it's the reverse, as I said earlier, because there are some which no longer fire. They still have a nasty smell from the quinones, which, by the way, aren't very nice things to touch. I mean, your fingers just get a bit brown where the quinone touches, but it's not a nice substance, but it won't kill you. But some of the beetles do use quinone, but they don't make it hot. Now, as I said to you, it's a twin carburetor job. You've got two combustion chambers. Here they are. And here's this long line down which the two chemicals, which are the main reactants, hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinone, come down. So it really is quite an amazing system. Here's a close-up of those two carburetors, as I call them. They actually look like boxing gloves. And now I'm coming to the point where I was speaking with Tom Eisner, and I said, I think you've got another valve here. And he agreed with me when we started talking. Because this is effectively the inlet valve. As the pressure goes up, right, it causes the two fingers of that glove to come together and to pinch the tube in which the reactants are coming down, right? So that's the inlet valve. So it switches everything off at high pressure, like with the V1. The trapdoor is closed, right? But there is also an exhaust valve. And that came from looking at this picture, which is looking at the same things. And you'll notice that this is the left-handed combustion chamber. And I looked at this, and I thought that Tom Eisner had sliced through the exhaust tube. He then told me, no, I didn't slice through the exhaust tube. You're looking at the outside. And I said, well, that's a bit of membrane. And he said, yes, it is. And that membrane, I could see, was soft and floppy and would lift up, right? It's normally like that. But then it lifts up that membrane, and the hard cuticle below stays put, but the membrane lifts up under high pressure. So it's a pressure relief valve. So now we understood, and my postdoc at the time and myself now both understood what was going on. We realized that we've got, it's similar to a pressure cooker. And it's only allowing the stuff to boil once you relieve the pressure at the back. And so we did some computer fluid dynamics modeling, and I won't go into all the detail of that. Suffice to say that we just took 1/8 of a total cylinder, and the blue represents cold water. We're not actually dealing with the chemistry here. And we're just saying that this is hot, it wants to boil, but it hasn't yet boiled. Everything is held by a little membrane here, which is not allowed to go until time t equals naught. At time t equals naught, that which is ready to boil but can't boil, because there's nowhere for the steam to go, is suddenly starts boiling. The reason we realize that this has to be going on is the speed at which the bombardier beetle releases the whole, not the whole, but a good part of the volume in 1/500th of a second, right? So we knew it had to boil off quickly. And we couldn't get the thing to work without it being under pressure first. And we then, you can look at the details afterwards if you're interested in the actual numerical experiment. But the ejected water and steam is going to come out to the right, and this is what happened. You can see here that this is 1 millisecond would be 1/1000th of a second. We're now up to 1/1000th of a second, okay? So we've still got a little way to go. We actually empty it in about 3 milliseconds, somewhere in that region. And the whole stuff is coming out because we got the physics right. We knew that we got everything under pressure first. We had to estimate what the pressure is. We couldn't actually put in a little pressure transducer. It's so tiny. To do any diagnostic experiments was almost impossible. I guess if you had a very lot of money, you could shine a laser through it and actually use laser tomography and other stuff, but we didn't have that available. But we did manage to plot things like velocity and mass exit rate, and everything was looking right. And so Swedish Biomimetics, which was the company which was sponsoring us, basically wrote out a check, which is rather nice, isn't it? When you actually, I was talking with at a conference about this, and he said, I would like to sponsor you building an experiment to simulate the beetle. I said, well, I've never done that before. So I gathered around people who knew about such things and knew far more than I did about how to make things. And we built our first rig, which looks like this. And this was our very first prototype where, okay, we have got everything right. But what we're doing here, what we're doing there is that we've got a chamber full of water. It wants to boil. It's been heated electrically. It's got an inlet valve, and it's got an exhaust valve. It also had a refill valve, but that's by the way. And we keep momentarily both valves closed and then open the exhaust valve, and out comes, the technical term for it is, a vapor explosion. If you're making steel, and I don't know whether you have steel made here, I can't remember all your industries here, but possibly you do. But if you're making steel, we used to make steel, but I don't think we do anymore. But you drop the molten steel into a bath, and you literally get a vapor explosion, right? It heats and vaporizes almost instantaneously. But the vapor occupies 1,000 times more than the similar mass of water. And so it's that change in volume which causes the enormous pressure. And this shows that we could shoot out a spray a great distance indeed. And I've got various experiments there, which I'm not going to major on now, because you've got the basic idea. But one thing I do just want to mention is that the throw ratio, which is the throw distance divided by the chamber length, was about 200 times. The chamber that we built was 2 centimeters as against 1 millimeter, okay? And we found that from 2 centimeters, we could actually get a distance of about 4 meters for the spray going out. As you can see, we had very sophisticated receptacles for receiving the spray, commonly called a bin. But that was in the early days. But we got it right, essentially. We could see that we got it about right. Because if I tell you that the bombardier beetle also has exactly the same throw ratio, now you can see why we were excited. Because from a 1 millimeter chamber, the beetle ejects a spray 20 centimeters. So we knew we got it somewhere about right. Indeed, this little film by David Attenborough shows you this feature.
But the master of chemical warfare is the bombardier beetle. It can create a chemical reaction within its body so violent that boiling caustic liquid explodes out of its abdomen. By pulsing the jet 500 times a second, it keeps its rear end just cool enough to prevent it being cooked.
Yeah, I'm not sure he's quite right about that. I think it has special material, which is yet another biomimetic possibility, which stops it heating its own body up. It has a separate skeleton to its digestive system. You know, it's not interfering with its digestive system. It has a separate skeleton where it keeps all these chemicals and running through its body. It's an amazing system. And so we can either have a single exhaust going across the room, which could be likened to a fire extinguisher, could be used for a fire extinguisher, or else we could have a spray with a wide spray for use in a fuel injector. So things worked exceedingly well. And although it's still not yet out in industry, it's getting there. And I'll just show you one of the later experiments, which actually just shows you the sorts of things that we have. This is one of the later ones. And you can now see that the spray, we've got up to very high frequency. We can get it up to about 100 cycles per second, even from a 2 centimeter chamber, which is very necessary for Formula One racing cars or any other application that there might be for this novel fuel inlet spray, right? That application, of course, wouldn't be using water. It would be using literally fuel heated up, right? And then going through our system and then ejected as a vapor. And that would get around the necessity of having to use special nozzles to break the spray into small particles. That becomes particularly important when you're dealing with diesel engines. So there's quite an application here for diesel engines because a huge amount of energy is needed to actually break down the fuel into tiny little droplets. So we don't have to do that. We do it by heating, which is actually more efficient than the other systems that are in existence. I'm going to now just comment briefly as I close on these various applications and then just close off on what really this is pointing to. The physics of the chamber and valve system We can control the inlet valve, the timing, the pressure relief exit valve, the temperature of the chamber, the repetitive pulse combustion, and so on and so forth. All this can be controlled. But the applications, as I mentioned, are pharmaceutical, fire extinguishers, fuel injectors, aerosols. Even aeroponics has been suggested as a possible use where you're trying to grow things in outer space or without gravity. There are possible further applications, but those are the main ones. But what this shows to us is that by careful design, we can actually get a system which meets the droplet size requirements. This is droplet size measured in thousandths of a millimeter. So it's what's called micrometers. So you've got 10 there for that application. And for fuel injectors, it's a little bit more than that, and so on. So we can, by careful design work, make something actually be applicable to what we need. Does that then mean that the Beetle just came about by accident? When we need to think very carefully about putting this the idea of this creature, the inspiration from this creature, applying it to our own work. There is another thing here. The University of Leeds very kindly didn't support me very well when people started complaining about the fact that, you know, I believe in creation, and others were... some people were writing in and just making life a bit of a misery. The University of Leeds, if you check up on me, you'll find that they still got this disclaimer on me. I thought, it's a very strange world. When it comes to getting prizes, they're there. But they're not interested in the originator of this work. You see, I give glory to the God who made this creature. I don't understand all the ins and outs as to what was going on at the very beginning in terms of how this creature was working, but I can see the mark of design. You could see the mark of design in the knobcone pine. You could see the mark of design when it comes to that walking protein, where right down at the molecular scale, at this very moment, you've got kinesins walking around in your cells, doing the job that they were designed to do and doing it very well, thank you. It seems to me not just a travesty of being against what the Word of God says. It's actually not giving... It's actually not proper science to try and suggest that those mechanisms could just make themselves. It's one thing to have all the elements together. I don't mean chemical elements. I just mean the components, right, of a bombardier beetle. But how are you going to actually gather all that together so that it all works at the right moment? That is the issue. Good experimental, solid, physical science shows to you that this is a brilliant engineer who put this together. This was someone who understood multi-phase liquids, right? Or liquids changing to gas. Phase changes, in other words. This is someone who understands the intricacy of vapor explosions. This is someone who understands the intricacies of catalytic chemistry, right? I still haven't worked out, by the way, how the bombardier beetle makes hydrogen peroxide. Did you know that it's a Laporte process at the moment, which is quite expensive for making H2O2, right? Okay, people do it quite regularly, and you can buy bleach quite easily now in the shops. But it would be a big winner if we could find out how this beetle at room temperature makes hydrogen peroxide, which is why I've set up this project with the University of Mississippi to see whether we can work that one out. If we can, there's a big winner there. And you see, and who gets the glory? Me? No. I tell you who has the glory. It's the one who made intricate creatures. In the Bible it says, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. Wherever you look, it gives glory to God. In the beginning was the Logos, the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. Let me tell you one last thing. In Romans 1, verse 20, it says, the invisible things of God are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Earlier, that passage talks about men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. I hope you're not thinking that evolution is the answer. Because evolution, by definition, is a philosophy of death. By definition. Because the only way in evolutionary terms to get something better is to talk of survival and to kill off the others, which are no good. Evolution fits very well with those who don't want God in their thinking. What really grieves me is when Christians reach out to evolution and try and embrace this philosophy of death into their own thinking. Don't do it if you're a Christian. Don't do it. You don't need evolutionary sophistry to understand the world. Evolution is not science. It's a religion. Evolution does not fit with hard, experimentally observed facts. It's a way of interpreting the universe. And it may appear to fit, but actually, when you investigate carefully, it doesn't. Evolution is really pushed by those who are in control of all the big-time financing of governments. Really, they don't want Christianity in their thinking. You've got evolution big time in this country, big time. You've actually had it being taught, I think, more strongly than in my own universities, although we've caught you up. The only reason that it's not spread like wildfire in this country is because there's quite a lot of Christians here. But I'm appealing to you as Christians, if you're a Christian here, to get to grips with this issue. Don't just let it sort of go over your head and say, oh, I don't need to worry about it. I'll just keep preaching the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, yes, but what about your children when they come back, having been at the University of Pretoria and have done a three-year course on evolutionary biology? And if you haven't got an answer to what they are saying such that you can show, you may not know all the details, but you can show that, A, the Bible has no religion of death. The created order was perfect. Death came after man's sin, right? Actually, if you look at it carefully, everything is telling you that the whole of the created order was perfect, okay? And number two, the science actually doesn't substantiate it, which is why I'm going to recommend those books at the back, which have been provided by Grace Media. Thank you very much. Is it Ruth? No, not Ruth. Linda and... Glyn, that's right. Linda and Glyn, very lovely couple at the back with the books there. You need the resources. Loads of resources there. You need to actually feed these resources to your own children and your own church families, where young people are being bombarded with this evolutionary religion. And you need to see that we have now trained scientists in the creation circles who have actually worked solidly, not only in engineering like I have, but have worked in biology, worked in astronomy, worked in all branches of science. There is no excuse today for Christians not to be informed. You need the resources. Talk with Belka, He'll feed you with loads more stuff, won't you, Balky? You know, you've got a lot of books. Luke, his son, pretty clued up as well, Lucas. And so, you know, folk, we've got people here in South Africa. There's other organizations. I'm not with them, but Creation Ministries International, they've got an office here. I think Answers in Genesis may have one or two people who also are contactable in this country as well. I'm with AIG, but I would delight with all these creation organizations being used effectively for promoting this important message. Thank you very much. God bless you. We'll start again in whenever it is.